made the decision with clear eyes. I will not send another generation of Americans to war in Afghanistan.
The withdrawal of America's longest overseas war leaves Afghanistan in chaos.
ساحه ټوله تر کنټرول دی مجاهدینو د طالبانو تر تسلط لاندې ده او موږ د خپلې ادارې فعال دي.
We were completely 100% lost when it came to the politics of the fight, who we were actually fighting, and then what the end game was.
The war on terror's impact is felt in the heart of America.
USA! USA! 10% of the people arrested for violence, criminal activity at the U.S. Capitol had either current or former military experience.
Al-Qaeda attacked the Twin Towers on September 11th, 2001. As a response, George W. Bush unleashed Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan.
The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice.
Osama bin Laden is hunted and killed. As years pass, objectives like nation building are added to America's plans in Afghanistan. But standing in the way of progress are the Taliban, experts in guerrilla warfare, who operate from treacherous terrains in the nation's south. Caught in this crossfire are Afghan civilians. More than 100,000 are killed by either US bombing campaigns or Taliban revenge attacks.
کابل کې د چهارشنبه ورځې ځانګړي ګډین کې د 15 کسانو زیاتو ژوند بایللی چې په پکې د ټرونیوز کار کوي.
In 2020, after more than $1 trillion, the United States aims for a political resolution. Former President Donald Trump signs a peace deal with the Taliban for a transition of power. President Biden followed through with a decision to withdraw all troops out of Afghanistan.
I made the decision with clear eyes. After 20 years, $1 trillion spent training and equipping hundreds of thousands of Afghan national security and defense forces. I will not send another generation of Americans to war in Afghanistan with no reasonable expectation of achieving a different outcome.
In July 2021, the nerve center of U.S. military operations at Bagram is swiftly evacuated. the Afghanistan National Army is put to its greatest test to defend Afghanistan on their own without any U.S. support. This is when a 75,000-strong Taliban offensive is launched across the country. Untrained to counter guerrilla warfare, the Afghan National Army falters. Many units surrender without a fight.
ساحه ټوله تر کنټرول دی مجاهدینو دی طالبانو تر تسلط لاندې ده او موږ د تخپل ادارې فعال دي.
Some accounts suggest 600,000 American weapons, 75,000 vehicles, and 200 aircrafts have now fallen into Taliban hands. American war veterans who served in Afghanistan are bitterly shocked by the collapse.
Keeping with American traditions, the Afghans would give us little certificates as we left. And so this was from 2009.
Jason Dempsey is a former army major who served for nearly 2 years in Afghanistan. During his 2009 deployment, he traversed Kunar, Vardak, Khost, and Paktia provinces in eastern Afghanistan, fighting the Taliban.
When I went to Afghanistan in 2009, we were very good at targeting, hunting, and killing, but we were completely 100% lost when it came to the politics of the fight, who we were actually fighting, and then what the end game was. There's a lot of morphing between, well, is the priority Al-Qaeda, or is our new enemy, you know, is our sworn forever enemy now the Taliban? We just painted them all with one broad brush. They were the enemy. That was the easiest thing to do. And then counting success as taking the fight to them without ever thinking about, well, why do they keep coming?
Jason's second tour was as an advisor to the Afghan military to train them to fight against the Taliban. The Afghanistan National Army's Sixth Corps totaled fewer than 300,000 soldiers. They were spread across a vast expanse and fully supported by American air power and intelligence information.
One of the biggest mistakes we made is we said, well, we're going to create an army that looks like us. And what we were doing was we were creating a national army for a nation that simply didn't exist. There are a lot of things that make our army effective and possible. Things like effective bureaucracies, the rule of law, a lack of sectarian violence, literacy, a force that's able to adapt and learn and use a lot of different technologies. Those things don't exist in Afghanistan.
President Ashraf Ghani's government's chronic corruption and mismanagement within the armed forces stood exposed in battles against the Taliban. More than $300 million a year was spent paying salaries to non-existent personnel in the Afghan security forces. One investigation found Afghan troop numbers to be as low as 50,000 when Kabul fell to the militant outfit. Afghanistan now ranked amongst 15 of the most corrupt countries in the world.
That's human nature. And so one, it's, you know, it was a, we blame the Afghans for, you know, siphoning off money and acting corrupt. And it's a bit of arrogance to think, you know, that we, in the exact same situation, wouldn't see the same thing, right? You don't just get, yeah, people are people everywhere. That's, you know, that was at one time part of our understanding of American exceptionalism. Now American exceptionalism is this fantasy that somehow we live a perfect life and we can export that to everybody just by diktat and not actually the hard work.
Low morale and abrupt withdrawal of U.S. support led to desertions within the Afghan army that swept across the country. The Taliban were also quick to use diplomacy and struck deals with Afghan military commanders.
You know, it was one of the hardest things about fighting the Taliban is, they were people's brothers, cousins, uncles, distant relatives, people who shared the same background and ethnicity. And when we turned them into the enemy, right, that not the enemy to negotiate with or work with or try to bring into the fold, but the enemy that must be decisively defeated, we bought ourselves a really long war when we kind of made that our focus.
Logistical support provided by U.S. contractors was no longer there. There was no reliable mechanism in place for contractors to keep the Afghan Air Force flying as Americans packed up.
Ansar, Maiwan, Ansar.
On the contrary, the battle-hardened Taliban's military advance was tactical and measured. More than 80% of the country's highways were in their control within days, cutting the Afghan army's supply routes.
We built this thing that simply cannot exist without us pouring billions of dollars and having folks standing behind and supporting them with maintenance and contracting and logistical and air support and air power. And we built a complete fantasy of a military for Afghanistan. The conundrum was, so long as we're there and as long as we're pouring billions of dollars into that, it directly undercut in many ways the political legitimacy of the central government and the forces out fighting, because they were seen as both puppets and they were seen as wildly corrupt.
The Taliban are now in full control, exactly 20 years after September 11th, 2001, with the fate of the country unknown. But the after effects of this war will continue to haunt veterans for years to come.
So many of the veterans in our generation have been exposed to burn pits and other airborne toxins while they're deployed.
More than 7,000 U.S. military service members have been killed in war operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. But despite the wars coming to an end, the human cost has not lessened as troops return to the United States. Those who survived the war are now battling on another front. More than 30,000 War on Terror veterans have taken their own lives. That's four times more deaths than in actual fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a suicide pandemic that has ravaged veteran families and communities. Thomas Ben Soot is a contributing author for the Cost of War Project. He studied suicide rates of service members and veterans of the post-9/11 wars.
The suicide numbers are staggering. Sort of ranges from 6,000 to 6,400 veterans every year die by suicide. That's where you get this, they would say 17 per day. Unfortunately, moral injury, feelings of burdensomeness to society, issues like taking on vice behaviors, like drinking, drug use, dangerous behaviors, all of these things can contribute to rising suicide rates.
By 2030, countering veteran suicide will account for more than $221 billion in public costs.
And 42% of the voting public doesn't know that we're at war, and you come back to that and you've sacrificed your life and your identity to protect these people, but they don't know that he did that sacrifice at all and they don't honor that sacrifice, creates, you know, a sense of isolation and alienation that you're, and just a, it leads to that dissonance that I've been talking about too.
Access to guns and the pandemic across the U.S. has made things worse. 17 veterans die from suicide on a daily basis. The majority of them from self-inflicted firearm injuries. Wiley Gray served as a staff sergeant of Marines as the ammunition chief in Helmand Province for 9 months in 2008. He survived two deployments in support of the War on Terror and ended with acute post-traumatic stress.
My own story was one where I felt like I was doing something patriotic until the moment I was in Afghanistan and I realized these people aren't a threat to America. These are tribal human beings living with basically nothing. Why are we in Afghanistan and Iraq? Can someone explain it? I've been asking that for years. It's a racket, is the answer. War is a racket. And it's paid for in blood. I got to the point where I remember, you know, having my grandfather's pistol. He has a 38 special. In fact, it's upstairs right now. I still have it. And I just decided I'm going to kill myself. I'm done. I've had this deployment long enough. I've taken enough suffering, and I think I'm done. And man, I remember feeling good after coming to the conclusion. I remember the palpable sense of, that's it, the deployment's gonna end soon.
In sheer desperation, Wiley decided to seek help. He boarded a flight to join an Amazon tribe in Peru. Individual therapy, aided by a locally made brew from rainforest plants, allowed him to reprogram and reset his mental defense mechanisms. He found sleep again and also came to terms with his trauma.
I felt, for the first time in my life, a sense of being whole. It was absolutely transformational. And when I was in ceremony one of the last times, I saw two people that I know, other veterans, next to me in ceremony. They weren't really there, but that's what I saw in my visions. And they were laughing, and they were smiling, and they were happy. And I knew it was because they'd found something just like I had.
His trauma became a mission to help others find safe and effective tools for recovery. Wiley established Veterans of War and committed to healing trauma through plant medicine. The War on Terror has also inflicted deep physical wounds on veterans. Nearly 3.5 million service members, like Leroy Torres, are victims of toxic exposure from burn pits.
What's wrong? What are you feeling? Tell me.
I got pressure, man.
Leroy was deployed at the U.S. Air Base Balad, Iraq. That's when his symptoms started to show.
Air? Will the air help you?
Oh, yeah. Balad had the largest burn pit in theater in Iraq. It was approximately 10 acres in diameter. And everything that was thrown into the trash was burned and doused with JPA fuel and burned. From plastic bottles, styrofoam, from the Balad hospital, they would burn medical waste, body parts, equipment, you name it. Everything was being burned. So that really took a toll.
In 2010, Leroy Torres returned to Texas. That's when he was diagnosed with constrictive bronchiolitis, a chronic lung disease. In 2018, he was diagnosed with toxic brain injury.
My disability, my state medical retirement was denied. Never in my wildest dreams would I thought that I'd be going through this hardship where I was worried about getting shot or maybe lose a limb or just IED, but never did it cross my mind that I would have to deal with something that I would be facing an invisible enemy. It's part of the war that followed me home. This is the actual picture of my lungs. And you can see all the inflammation here and all this right here. Yeah, I said this is it's irreversible. It's a condition you have to deal with the rest of your life.
Jason is a 44-year-old Delaware resident and veteran.
85,000 veterans have sought treatment for illnesses possibly tied to burn pits. A fraction of the 3.2 million service members believed to have been exposed. Nearly 75% of veterans' burn pit claims have been rejected to date. Leroy and his wife started the non-profit group Burn Pits 360 to aid other veterans suffering from internal scars of war. They built the Warrior Support Center in Texas, offering services to veterans in the area.
Hey.
We don't have time. People are dying, and time is of essence. It's the one thing they don't have, is time. So we're way past the 20-year mark of when this should have been addressed. It's sort of criminal for the VA and DoD to continue stalling the way they have, to continue using science against us. I mean, I think the recent action that's happened is only because we've had people like John and John with us.
Comedian and activist John Stewart joined them to voice support for legislation to care for veterans who have suffered toxic exposure. Afghanistan war veteran Tom Porter is helping them in Washington, D.C.
To illustrate how diverse these exposures are. For example, in Kabul, a city of over a million people, but without a modern sewer system. So you've got airborne feces that blows around there, and you're breathing that. That's what I breathed every day. But then you've got diesel generators that would power all of our operations. They're probably half the size of this room, and they're belching black smoke. And service members are breathing that every day.
In May 2021, the Burn Pits team marched to Washington, D.C. They demanded to include 23 respiratory illnesses on the list of conditions that will qualify veterans for VA benefits and health care.
We need a presumption of the various cancers and respiratory illnesses and immunodeficient disorders and lymphomas that are occurring in the veterans population for all these toxic exposures. Defense contractors can't view the U.S. Congress as Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, while veterans are back there like Oliver with a bowl of gruel asking, "Please, sir, may I have some more?"
A bill was introduced in the Senate on March 2021. It will provide benefits to veterans with illnesses caused by exposure to burn pits and other toxins. It's a small ray of hope for Leroy, who's been waiting for nearly a decade to get his injury claims approved. But some veterans are getting disillusioned as the U.S. government instead focuses on bringing Afghan refugees into the country.
USA! 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 USA!
America's war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq have come to a close after 20 long years. Its major goal was to ensure that America's external enemies lose the ability to plot, plan, and execute another 9/11. But what about America's domestic security situation? Some experts suggest spikes in domestic white supremacist activism have regularly followed the closure of major military hostilities. After the end of the First and Second World War, immigration into the United States and the civil rights movements for racial equality resulted in the rise of the Ku Klux Klan.
The dominant aspect of the Ku Klux Klan in terms of prejudice or extremism is actually nativism. It's anti-immigrant belief. Their slogan was 100% Americanism. And this was at a time when the United States is undergoing huge amounts of immigration from Southern Europe, from Eastern Europe. And these are people who are Eastern Orthodox. They're Catholics. They're Jews. They're not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And so this sort of 100% Americanism was a reaction to that immigration, and they become a very anti-immigrant, very nativist group.
After the withdrawal from Vietnam and the first Gulf War in the late 90s, white power groups then attempted to recruit active duty soldiers, reservists, and veterans to form militias.
In the 1990s, you have the third main anti-government extremist movement emerge, the militia movement. And they also have these conspiratorial theories about the government being illegitimate. But the militia movement says the whole rest of the world has essentially been taken over by a globalist one-world government. The United States is one of the last bastions of freedom, but our own government is actually collaborating with the New World Order to slowly strip us of our rights and freedoms, starting with our right to keep and bear arms, because once we lose that right, we won't be able to defend any of our rights.
Death to our enemies!
Death to our enemies!
These extremist white groups found political legitimacy with the arrival of Donald Trump and an election campaign that deeply polarized the country.
How do you come up with that decision?
Donald Trump, they say Donald Trump has his dividing the nation because of all this. He's not dividing the nation, he's revealing what's already there. This division has already been there for years.
When Klan leaders say that they feel like national politics are going in some sense their way, they're not entirely wrong. They are absolutely in love with Donald Trump in particular, and see him as, in the words of one neo-Nazi website out there, our glorious leader.
The divisions in American society came to a climax in 2020 when Donald Trump went into an election battle against Joe Biden.
Hi, Shazad. This is Chris Hill on the radio. You know, you kind of identify yourselves.
Hit. Hill served the United States as a Marine from 1994 to 1998 in Hawaii. He fears immigrants will take over the United States.
By the end of the century, by 2099, we'll have 500 million people, and the increase of about 200 million will probably be from illegal immigration and descendants of illegal immigration.
Go!
Stepping off first. Second squad, you got six.
Ready?
Hook. I think, you know, Donald Trump stood for America first. Make America great again, America first. I know it's a process, a lot of processes, but American people should have more money. So that, to me, that's my, one of the rally cries that I have, in addition to the insurmountable debt. But I'm worried about my country, and it is being overwhelmed and flooded with welfare and illegal immigration, and to the tune of over $20 trillion in debt, and you know, it was just going to collapse under its own weight.
Some estimates suggest veterans like Chris Hill now make up at least 25% of militia rosters in the United States.
Yeah, so back in 2009, when I wrote the now notorious Department of Homeland Security right-wing extremism report, I did have a little section in there that talked about returning veterans and how they could potentially be recruited by these, you know, right-wing extremist groups to boost the violent capabilities of these groups and help them train and you know, perfect their skills. So one of the ways that they recruit online is through websites, Twitter accounts. They even have online communities that are private.
Guns up!
Ready, ready, ready.
Moving. Boom!
I am white. I am proud military. I am Christian. I am a Second Amendment enthusiast. And now, supposedly, I'm the terrorist. I don't want to risk going to jail and getting charged with a bunch of crap and ruining my life. But I'm mad enough. I'm mad as hell. I can't take it anymore. And I'm going to exercise my damn rights everywhere in this country that I go.
I'm going to shoot across and you hook, okay? Moving.
In 2021, Chris Hill reiterated this message on a nondescript online website that has now been taken down. Hill discussed why it was important to overthrow the United States government by violence if necessary. His video comes a few weeks after the January 6th terror attack when white militias descended on Capitol Hill. A joint session of Congress had gathered on the day to certify the victory of Joe Biden in the US elections of 2020. But supporters of Donald Trump had other plans. They dubbed it the Stop the Steal movement. The aim was to forcibly reinstate Donald Trump as president of the United States of America.
The movement started on Facebook and other groups. In fact, it started before it hit those platforms. But shortly after Election Day, shortly after President Trump falsely and prematurely claimed that he had won the election, the beliefs that the election was stolen, that Democrats rigged the election and stole it for President Joe Biden, stole it from former President Donald Trump with widespread voter fraud.
USA! USA! USA!
We surprised them. We took them by surprise. And this year, they rigged an election. They rigged it like they've never rigged an election before.
The Stop the Steal movement spread like wildfire on the internet as more protesters arrived.
I spent my last year of government service as a senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the Trump administration. So that the role of President Trump and his rhetoric, that I think is part and parcel of that discussion about misinformation and disinformation and the polarized nature of politics.
As word spread that the vote count was underway, rioters overpowered the Washington, D.C. police. Their calls for backup go unheard. As Capitol Hill police struggles with lack of support, the rioters, supported by serving and former military men, break into Capitol Hill. The breaches happen from at least 8 points. The limited security inside Capitol Hill escorts members into the bunker. Joshua Macias, a 6-year Navy veteran from Virginia, was outside Capitol Hill that day.
We believed in you, Vice President! We had hope that you would do what's right for our Constitution! I stood with you on stage, sir! We believed in you! You backstabbed the veterans! You backstabbed these patriots! That's why we're here!
As the then co-founder of Vets for Trump, he believed veterans had a reason to join the rioters.
They saw that they were being kicked to the back of the bus when it comes to other socioeconomic concerns, and they're being treated like a lesser demographic, and that even illegal aliens were getting treated better than veterans, because veterans understood the why, and that's where they wanted to see change. And so that's what then unearthed and created Vets for Trump Club and community.
As night falls and reinforcements arrive, the National Guard take back Capitol Hill. Instead of downplaying the attack, former President Trump called the attackers great patriots.
In our review of court filings for the first 430 or so people who were charged in relation to the events on that day, many defense attorneys have argued in court, or at least a handful, that President Donald Trump was responsible for convincing their clients that the election was stolen, that they needed to come to Washington, D.C. to fight against the outcome of the election, and that their support mattered.
Videos, pictures, and CCTV footages are now being scrutinized by the U.S. government to make arrests.
10% of the people arrested for violence, criminal activity at the U.S. Capitol had either current or former military experience. And so what has the military done? Very little. It was fine for military members to belong to a militia group. You know, military members that have belonged to militia groups, such as the 3%ers, that have committed violent acts against, people, police officers, plotted bombings and shootings.
Despite the arrests, Chris Hill and the 3%ers in Georgia continue their movement. The Department of Homeland Security is expected to undergo an internal review to root out white supremacy and extremism in its ranks. The January 6th riots and Capitol Hill siege has left more question marks on militias and veterans that join them.
We've had militia groups protesting against what they perceive as impending Sharia law that's coming into their communities, that there's this like Muslim invasion. And some of these things actually made it into presidential policy.
After the break, we investigate the rise of Islamophobia amongst war veterans and those fighting against it. The attacks on the Twin Towers by Muslim men changed the discourse of Islam in the United States forever. Research Institute New America Foundation says 2 in 5 Americans believe Islam is incompatible with U.S. values. This distrust and hostility towards American Muslims has caused a rise in Islamophobic attacks. Just 1% of Americans follow Islam. A U.S. government survey reports that 14.5% of all hate crimes in 2018 were motivated by anti-Islamic sentiments. Among others, one reason for this hatred against American Muslims is the impact the war on terror has had on its war veterans.
There's been multiple studies about the rise of Islamophobia coinciding with returning veterans coming back from the Middle East. You know, when veterans come home, they come back from these war zones where they've been taught and trained and conditioned to believe that people wearing turbans, having long beards, and having these funny sounding names with brown skin are the threat.
As part of the Cost of War project, Thomas Ben Suit researched on the role of Christianity in post 9/11 U.S. veterans.
The military uses Christian symbols and sort of ways of talking about military service as it would align specifically with a sort of Christian narrative. The chaplains in the military are overwhelmingly white, it's over 74%. They're overwhelmingly evangelical, it's over 63%. And they're overwhelmingly men, it's like 95%, something like that. And so it ends up being this religious culture that is specifically right-leaning.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were perceived by some veterans as a clash of civilizations, a war between Christianity and Islam. Richard McKinney saw Rambo films as his inspiration and joined the Marine Corps to be involved in the action. But he returned from Iraq with a hatred for Muslims.
I developed a deep hatred for Islam over a course of several years, being in the military and having to deal with these people in a harsher climate, maybe, I guess is the best way to put it, a harsher existence. I saw it as my position in life to rid the world of as many Muslims as I possibly could. And I attempted that while I was overseas. And after I was medically retired because I was in an accident in Iraq.
That's when Richard decided to make a homemade bomb. Then set it across the Islamic center of Muncie in a banked parking lot. And in his words, watched the show. But the day he wanted to execute it, a chance encounter with his daughter changed the course of his life.
So my daughter came home, she asked me about it. I snapped, and I saw the look on my daughter's face. And this is somebody who I've had so much love and admiration for in the course of her life that I couldn't even begin to describe it. And she looked at me like I was absolutely the craziest person she'd ever seen. And it was kind of like she was questioning her love for me. That hit me hard. So I figured the best way to do to make sure that I was okay was to go meet these people.
Richard decided to visit the same Islamic center of Muncie instead. The imam gave him the Quran to read.
And they would explain it how I could understand it. And I was like, oh, that makes sense, you know? So, long story short, after 8 weeks, I went from getting ready to blow this building up to coming back saying, I want to take Shahada. I want to take my declaration of faith.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. On no soul doeth Allah place a burden greater than it can bear.
More than 700 anti-Muslim incidents have taken place from 2012 to 2018.
We had a number of arsons that have happened to mosques here in the United States, many of them unsolved. We've had militia groups protesting against what they perceive as impending Sharia law that's coming into their communities, that there's this like Muslim invasion. And some of these things actually made it into presidential policy.
But some veterans are fighting against the rise of anti-Muslim hate crimes in the United States. Mansur Shams is known as the Muslim Marine. He's part of only 4,000 Muslim Americans who served in the U.S. Army, making up just 0.3% of the military.
Allahu Akbar.
I was on active duty, so yep, I was in the middle of my Marine Corps career at that time. And when 9/11 happened, just like most people who lived that day, I remember what was going on. And unfortunately, like when I it pained me a lot that days later when we found out that these hijackers happened to be so-called Muslims. And I think that has given Muslims and others, perhaps as well, a bad reputation. And unfortunately, when the 9/11 attacks happened, essentially 19 hijackers hijacked an entire faith of 1.8 billion plus. It was an attack on me. It was an attack on my family. And what I mean by my family, my American family, you know?
Having been born in Pakistan and a practicing Muslim, Mansur did face difficult questions from his own community.
They're part of the Muslim community that they're shocked that this is a guy who has served the U.S. Armed Forces. I mean, I do get messages from time to time, you're a Muslim killer, and you call yourself a Muslim or this and this and that. The Islamic faith actually requires Muslims to be loyal to their country of residence. So that means there was never a conflict of interest when it came to, contrary to what is out there, between my faith and me becoming a United States Marine.
Although he was never deployed overseas, Mansour felt that a greater conversation needed to take place inside America. He started MuslimMarine.org to counter hate, bigotry, and Islamophobia through education, conversation, and dialogue.
So being a Muslim or being an American, my first right, according to the Quran, not even just the Constitution, is to be loyal to the country I'm living in, to be contributing to society in a positive way. So when I do that, or if he does that, then we stand on a position of saying, hey, look, I'm contributing in a positive manner. You share a voice that has impact. You're not just coming from the sides, you're coming from within in a positive manner where you're part of them. So when they see you and you create these dialogues, when you sit and you eat together and you talk about these things openly, then you create understanding. People will incline towards goodness. I think, as our faith teaches, there are more good people in this world than bad. And I believe that.
As the United States begins to pick up the pieces from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq 20 years after 9/11, Mansour believes there are lessons for America to learn.
The United States of America has made some really, really, really bad decisions, you know, when it comes to its war and the way it sells it to the American public. You know, we look at Iraq. Over a million innocent, largely innocent, Iraqis killed. For what? I mean, they were living, breathing human beings just like you and I were. We need to really re-examine ourselves, and we need to apologize. We need to make up for our mistakes.